Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The sound of the cello may, if you listen, be heard in the heart, invoking a kaleidoscope of emotions on a magic carpet ride of sound. Joel Cohen, cellist extraordinaire, has performed with the Oakland Symphony Orchestra, the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, and currently lives in Mendocino County, California. When Joel Cohen visited the studios of Radio Curious, he described his friend the cello, bowed it to life so it could speak and sing to us. And that's Joel Cohen playing his cello along with our theme song, The Lost Cowboy, by Peter Ellman, that you usually hear on this program without such a fine cellist accompanying it. Our conversation with Joel Cohen, recorded on April 26, 2010, began with him describing how his relationship with the cello began. Joel Cohen, welcome to Radio Curious.
Why, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's talk about you and the cello. How long have you been playing your friend the cello?
I started as a kid. I came from a musical family and played a little piano when I was really young, and I started cello just before my 9th birthday, so about 100 years.
Was cello your choice?
Well, my older brother was already playing the violin. And one day a cello appeared and my mother said, "Here, you're going to play this." So in that sense, no, I didn't choose it. I took quite easily to it. But for a number of years, I resented the fact that I was being forced to play. And somewhere in high school, middle school, high school, I started to realize I was enjoying it and making friends with it and getting noticed with it. And I sort of, it metamorphosed into my choice.
So in many aspects, the cello has become an intimate part of your life.
Oh, absolutely.
It's your profession.
It's more than a profession. To be a musician, it has to be sort of an all-encompassing thing. Not that it's my only interest, but it's really an avocation too. It's my hobby as well as my bread and butter.
When something is your bread and butter, as in music, you don't have the same 9-to-5 kind of job. I would imagine, and I'd like to hear your experience, that there's an extensive amount of practicing and rehearsal and preparation for the event.
It depends entirely on what kind of event we're talking about. If it's a solo performance, then there's a great deal of work that goes into it. I mean, some chamber music is easy and just needs to be reviewed a little bit before you go to a rehearsal, and then rehearse it to work out how you're doing things with other people. Or the same goes for orchestra, and some things are extremely difficult in chamber music and orchestral repertoire and take a lot of practice. But when it's a solo performance or a duo, cello and piano or something like that, then it tends to take a lot of work.
Well, let's talk about a project that you're now working on. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Brahms Double Concerto for violin and cello.
Violin and cello are the solo instruments, so it's violin and cello and orchestra. So in that sense, it's a normal concerto, although in the standard repertoire and in the romantic 19th and 20th centuries, it's the only concerto that I'm aware of that is for two instruments and orchestra. At least well into the 20th century. It's a wonderful piece of music that was written as a reconciliation with Josef Joachim, who was one of the preeminent violinists in Germany in the 19th century. And he and Brahms had been friends and colleagues for many years. And when Joachim went through a divorce, Brahms wrote a letter to the court siding with Joachim's wife. Apparently, it was a big drawn-out battle to get divorced in the 19th century. And Joachim would not forgive him for that. He was appalled that he would stand up for his wife. And their relationship stopped cold for many years. And in the 1880s, I don't know exactly how long, but this piece was written in 1887. I believe that Robert Hausmann, the cellist in the Joachim Quartet and teacher at the Berlin Academy of Music, which Joachim had started in the 1860s, Hausmann acted as an intermediary and between Brahms and Joachim. Basically, what you get in this piece is a conversation, an argument. You get two voices, the violin and the cello. I think it's pretty clear that they're meant to represent Brahms and Joachim, although I can't tell you which one is whom. I like to think I'm Brahms, but it could very well be that Joe Edelberg, the violinist, thinks that he is. And the piece starts with a fairly angry or upset statement. It starts, after a couple of measures, the cello comes in and plays a cadenza that's quite intense and focused, and it's like somebody stating their case and is quite upset about the whole thing. And then the violin comes in, and throughout the piece, there are places where the instruments are arguing with each other. There are places where they complement each other, and there are places where they play together, either in unison or in harmony. And it's very much like a conversation, an argument, some sort of working toward a reconciliation. And that is, in fact, what happened. Joachim accepted this as a reconciliation with Brahms, and they became friendly again after this. And both Joachim and Robert Hausmann, the cellist, did the premiere of the piece with Brahms conducting in 1887 or 1888.
Can you play some of it for us?
Sure, I could play the opening. The orchestra plays the first four bars. And then the cello comes in. Comes in, and then the violin follows almost immediately. It's a counterpoint to what I've been playing. He's upset too, and that's he's telling me that. I've announced to him that I'm upset about something that's going on here. If you just think of it as the whole piece as a conversation, it works really well. It's really unique in that sense. It's not just solo instruments playing pretty tunes and then the orchestra plays the tunes when the solo instruments aren't playing. It's much more complex than that.
You were telling me about music being a language, comparing it to French and German, and we were talking in English, so of course, to English. Can you talk more about that, music as a language?
Well, language is communication. It's the ways that different people or peoples have found to communicate and express thoughts, directions, emotions. Music is a language in the same sense, but it goes directly to the right side of the brain, to the emotional side. It's communication at an emotional level without confusion of words that often happens in language. Words can be used to communicate. They can also be used to obfuscate things, depending on how you want to use it. And music does have this direct communication with people. When I'm playing a concert, whether it's a concerto or a chamber music, me alone or me with a piano or with other instruments, I consider it a success when I take people on a trip, it's like a magic carpet ride, and everybody's picture of what happens is their own. So I would be really surprised to hear different people say, yeah, that's what I heard too. It's like when you go to a concert, if it's a good concert, they take you where you are and bring you to places in yourself that you want to go to or that you need to go to. And if it's good music and if it's well played, it's more than just a scenic trip. It's a way to deal with emotional things that are going on in our own lives as listeners.
Are you saying that this is different, the conversation that occurs in music, than it would be if someone who had no ability to understand English, who had never heard English before, were listening to us talk now and hear the sounds that we make with our voices?
When we listen to music, we each individually go into our own brain, into our own feelings. So everybody hears a different story. So in the sense of relating a chain of events or directions that you have to do, that's not the language that music speaks. But it's a language in the sense that there's very, very specific communication happening, or very real communication happening from me, the performer, to you, the listener, if I'm doing more than just playing the notes.
And this is music without understandable or comprehensible words to it.
Oh, of course, you know, if you're dealing with poetry, with something that's sung, that's just combining different aspects of communication. It's like there's radio where you just listen and create pictures in your mind of what the people look like or what they're talking about. And with television, you're connected by sound and you're connected visually. So you're actually using less imagination when you're watching television than when you're listening to radio. In the same sense, when I'm accompanying something that somebody is singing with words, there's a story that they're telling, and that's sort of the concept is that you're going with that story. And it's a little bit more instrumental and not, there are no words or lyrics.
That's what I'd like you to describe. But before you do, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Joel Cohen, cellist extraordinaire from Redwood Valley, California. And this is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Joel, what is that essence that you can bring as a musician, pronouncing the sounds through the medium of your instrument, the cello?
When I take a new piece of music, or an old piece for that matter, old to me, or doesn't matter when it was written, I have a responsibility as a player to figure out the notes that I've been asked to play. If I'm a Celtic fiddler, I am figuring out the notes that somebody else wrote down as a piece and learning those. If I'm playing Brahms, I'm looking at what Brahms told me to play. And after I can handle the notes, I start to, it's like connecting the dots. There's more than the notes. Through the layout of the notes, and more importantly, the harmony and the rhythmic pulse that's set up in a piece, whether it's Brahms or fiddling or blues or any kind of music, there's a musical aspect that's very hard to articulate, but you have to communicate while using the pulse and the notes that are there for you. If you're improvising, you're freed from somebody else's notes or notes that you've written down before, but there's still, you have to set up expectations, both rhythmically and harmonically, and sometimes those are fulfilled and sometimes they are not. And the surprise of moving away from where you thought something was going is something that can trigger thoughts or feelings in us. And that's how music works mechanically.
Can you talk about the trigger? What is triggered?
I can't tell you specifically what is triggered. I know some of the tricks that are used in music, like deceptive cadences, like leading toward a chord that you think is going to come and then it doesn't come. Something else comes. It turns a different way. And I can tell you the mechanics of it, where in Bach's time, they would take a dominant 7 chord and write it as an augmented 6th chord, and that way it would resolve outwards instead of inwards to the normal, with the leading tone going up and the 7th coming down and the bass note dropping a 5th.
Can you play something that would demonstrate the resolution outward instead of inward, and the dominant instead of the subdominant?
What I just described, a dominant 7th, normally leads to the tonic. And I'm describing this more in classical terms, but it applies to jazz as well. 7th chords lead to around the circle of 4ths in jazz. We talk about the circle of 5ths in classical, but it's really the same thing, just in a different direction. And classical works the same way. So this leads to the expectation of this. But if I go, just the sense of, oh, that's something I didn't expect. Basically, it's about setting up expectation and sometimes fulfilling that and sometimes twisting things and making a surprise.
Well, Joel Cohen, let's talk about the instrument that you play. You mentioned that, and I believe you were referring to cellos as well as violins, but you mentioned that we're now in the second golden era of violin making. What do you mean? And perhaps you could put that into a current posture by describing the first golden era of violin making.
The first golden age of violin making was when, maybe 100 years after they were invented in the mid-16th century, like the 1560s, I believe. Andrea Amati was perhaps the first one to create the violin. At that time, the string instruments of choice and that were available were the viol family, viola da gamba, which is a family of instruments similar to a violin family. And they look superficially similar, but there are a lot of differences. And the violin was developed in Italy then, and over the period of 100 or 150 years, it was brought to what's considered its height with Stradivari and Niccolo Amati, a little bit before Stradivari. And there were many famous makers and even families of makers, Guarneri, Guadagnini, there are lots of them.
Primarily Italian,
yes. It happened in northern Italy. Cremona was the center of that development, but a lot of cities, mostly in the north. And throughout the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries, those were the instruments of choice because they were the best sounding, and they carried through a hall, particularly when we got to larger and larger halls. It's kind of remarkable because it's really just an 16th century amplifier, pre-electricity.
That's the violin and the
violin
shapes.
Or the cello. I mean, basically, it's just a wooden amplifier for these strings that started out good, and we've progressed to metal for the most part. So the first golden era of violin making was Stradivarius, Antonio Stradivari, like around 1700. So what happened is over the next couple hundred years after that, they were making instruments in Italy and in France and in Germany and in England, but they never really achieved the heights of construction and sound in particular of the golden era of Italian violin making. So when I came along in the mid 20th century, and I was playing cello, if I wanted to be professional, I had to get an old instrument, preferably old Italian. That was it.
You say had to. Why was this a command?
Because new instruments were simply not as good, and they were looked down on. If I got a good orchestra job, and I showed up with a brand spanking new cello, they would have looked at me like, what's that, and why are you playing it? Why don't you get yourself a good instrument? And what happened was, over the centuries, but in particular in the 20th century, there were more and more schools where high-level string playing was taught in Europe, in Austria, in Germany, in England, in France, in America with Juilliard and Curtis and Eastman and other schools. And more students turned out every year looking for great instruments, and the prices skyrocketed. They got more and more and more expensive, so that an aspiring young artist, unless they were given an instrument by an institution or a collector, couldn't afford great new instruments. And about that time, I would say the last quarter of the 20th century, it became possible for the really gifted new makers to make wonderful instruments. There was enough development that they were making instruments that sounded as good as the old Italians. And it became possible for violin makers to make a living making new instruments, just like Antonio Stradivari did, instead of making a living repairing instruments and making new instruments as a hobby.
And that's the second golden era
that you speak of. So I would say that we're in it now. There are makers now that make extraordinary instruments that are absolutely world-class and concert hall quality, and they are now accepted in the musical world as viable alternatives to million-dollar instruments. My instrument is 14 years old. It was made in Petaluma. If I were to get an instrument like this from the 18th century in Italy, it would probably cost me, sounding this good, it would probably cost me $300,000 to $500,000. Those instruments are only available in a finite number, and there are a huge number of people playing, and there are also collectors looking for these instruments, and that just drives the prices up.
Can you give us a comparison as to the value of your instrument?
Without putting a price tag on mine, I would say that really great concert quality cellos are, I would say, in the $40,000 to $60,000 or $70,000 range now, as opposed to $350,000 to $500,000 for old Italian of comparable quality and much more fragile because they're several hundred years old. When I, you know, get on a plane, if my name were Yo-Yo Ma, they would buy me 2 first-class tickets and I would go anywhere I wanted and I could go with a soft case. But for most traveling musicians, you get a good case and you check it and you hope that nothing happens. And usually nothing happens. Right now, there's a famous song on YouTube by a guitarist in a band from, I think, Nova Scotia, where they were sitting in the band flying to the States and somebody behind him shouted, "They're throwing guitars." And he looked out to see his guitar flying through the air because the baggage guys were playing tag with it or playing catch. And they dropped his guitar and broke it. And United Airlines refused to pay. They said, "We won't have anything to do with it." He said, "You know, I'll have to write a song, put it on YouTube." They said, "Yeah, sure. Good luck with that, buddy." And now United Airlines is trying to buy that back from him to take it off the air, and he won't. It's quite entertaining. United Breaks Guitars is what it's called on YouTube.
Well, Joel Cohen, this is fascinating. Joel and his cello. I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
One is, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I've managed to keep playing music as the main center of my life, which is what I want to do. And I'm living in the best place I can imagine living. And I want to keep performing music. I love teaching and I love performing, and I'm doing both. So I'll choose this. Thank you.
Well, for us to have you nearby is a wonderful gift. And
there are many wonderful musicians around here in Mendocino County. And we're close to the Bay Area, and Santa Rosa Symphony is close, so I get my classical fix and I get my non-classical fix, and it's a nice mix what we have here, and there are a lot of good concerts happening here.
In your personal experience, was there a eureka or an aha moment?
There have been several watersheds where I arrive at a point, at a realization that something is working right. It's not one moment that changed my life. That has not happened to me. But I've had many experiences that made me feel like I'd reached a new level. I can remember one shortly after I finished most of my formal training, the university part and conservatory part. When I had returned to the Bay Area, I grew up in Oakland, and I was at a California Cello Club meeting. And I'd been working and working and working 4, 6, 8 hours a day practicing the cello, learning hard pieces, figuring out how to get around, trying to figure out what playing in tune is and how to do it. And I was sitting there with a friend who played in the opera, who I knew from before, and we were at the cello club meeting, and they'd put some piece out where everyone was going to play, and people were moaning and groaning about how hard it was. And it was in some obscure key, and there were difficulties, but it wasn't hard for me. And it was like, oh, I can do this now. Because I'd spent so many years just slaving over the instrument, trying to figure out how to move my arm to shift, how to move the bow to get a good sound, where to go with the finger, which finger to use, how to hold your finger, how to vibrate. I tell my students now there are about 125 things you have to do right, all at the same time, to play the cello. And no one can remember that many things. It's not possible. So what we do is I feed them about 5 of those things at a time and have them do it not until they get it right, but until they can do it automatically. And when something like how you're sitting, when that becomes automatic, then I can add, well, hold the bow like this. Well, move the bow like that. Put your hand on the cello and let your arm feel like this. You know, each thing comes after if I could tell you right now in an hour, every single thing you need to do to play the cello, but that wouldn't mean you can play the cello. You have to train your body just like an athlete.
And finally, moving away from the magic of music to the magic of words, can you tell us about an interesting book?
One of my favorites is a Tom Robbins book called Skinny Legs and All. Well, first of all, one of the most striking things about that book is that it's not written in chapters. It's written in veils, in 7 veils. And at the end of each section, somebody has a veil torn from their eyes and they see things how they really are instead of how they've been led to believe or assumed. And in fact, in that book, there is a dancer called Salome, just to bring full circle to the 7 veils, because those who know opera or actually literature or the Bible know about Salome and her dance of 7 veils when she's trying to get the head of John the Baptist. There's a Richard Strauss opera dealing with that subject, and this book deals with that and lots of things. It's a wonderful book, and I love recommending it to people.
Well, Joel Cohen, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Joel Cohen is a professional cellist extraordinaire, living and working in Mendocino County, California. The book he recommends is Skinny Legs and All by Tom Robbins. This interview was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on April 26, 2010. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast by clicking on our website. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. Our programs are recorded in our studios in Ukiah, California. Hannah Bird heads our post-production staff. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.